On the Ground is produced by the Global NGO Executive Committee, a storied nonprofit that has for 60 years partnered with the United Nations to guarantee a voice at the decision-making table for civil society leaders. GNEC offers services to more than 1,600 UN-vetted global NGOs, which are on the front lines of tackling the most pressing issues of our time. I'm Adrienne Berg, a member of the NGO Committee on Aging New York and the host of On the Ground. We are so happy today to have with us Dasse Diarra. You may know him as the board member, one of our board members, esteemed board members at GNEC, but you may not know that he is also now the acting director and the United Nations main representative from Olof Palme Peace Foundation International. He says it's OPPFI, and it's particularly relevant that we be interviewing him today because, as you know, one of the themes this month of the United Nations, and here at GNEC, we try to follow those themes and illuminate more about them with regard to our NGOs, is peace. Peace and tolerance, two very big words, and let's see if we can unpack them with Acting Director of OPPFI, Dasse Diarra. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the mission of the foundation. Obviously, it has the name Peace in it, so this is a very meaningful mission to you. Explain the mission of OPPFI.
Thank you for the question. The mission of OPPFI is we are working to really help, to give a second chance to women, like the battered women and children. We know that nobody should be left behind right now, the way the world is. So we have a particular approach to really helping battered women and children, unfortunate children, or to bring them back into the society, to make them more active and create a future for them.
Well, this is really noble and not so easy. Geographically, the people that you help, where in the world are they likely to be? What's your target geography?
Well, the target geography is actually, I can say, the entire humanity. Mm-hmm. You know, everywhere in the world right now needs help, needs cooperation, needs mutual prosperity, needs of a particular attention. So we are actually working, you know, in that channel, but we are for now represented in some countries. We are not everywhere yet, of course, it's our goal
to be represented
everywhere in the world.
But, well, that's why you have international at the end of the foundation's name.
Right. That's right.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. So you did mention, though, a moment ago that you have a very particular approach to abuse, battering, and so on for children and women. What's the approach that you take? Is it part of getting them back into their own new lives? What would you call your distinction between what you're doing and what some of the other programs are like?
Well, first of all, we try to identify them. That is very important. We identify. Of course, this is, as I said, everybody is suffering somewhere in some ways, you know, and many without voice. So the first step is identifying who are really in that desperate condition. And in countries like where we are, we try to bring them together. You know, some are really completely desperate and no way and no support whatsoever. So once we identify them, so we try to create some kind of orphanage style, even if it is not orphanage, but try to really create a kind of center where they can really go every time and really have their voice heard. And for those who are more interested, they can even start some kind of education, you know, in those centers, and training, education, and that can be skillful works and everything else, so that they will come out of their situation, probably not with where they were before, but create their own reality and become very independent and more productive also within their society.
So, you know, in today's language, we would say it's an empowerment. It's a service program. It's an empowerment program with a particular target. Now, when we talk about peace, and of course, peace is in the name of your organization, we generally think about things like world peace, and we think about things like wars and what's going on in the Middle East and what's going on in the Ukraine. I mean, this is the first thing that comes to mind. But you're talking about something else here that might be the road, the pathway to world peace, and that's inner peace. The kinds of people that you are serving are the kinds of people that need a great deal more inner peace. So how do you work psychologically? I mean, these are people who have been through, let me say, hell. What do you do for them for that part of your approach so that you really do create peace internally?
Right. I mean, the very first step for anybody to be at peace is, you know, have somebody to share the pain, the thought, you know. This is very important because once we have somebody to whom to talk to, you know, is a way to discharge, is a way to really put down our burden, is the way to understand that, okay, at least somebody is here to listen to me. Somebody really cares for me. Somebody is really willing to take time to listen to what I am going through. And that really takes the burden 50%. If we speak about peace in general, you know, peace is a big umbrella. You know, it's a big umbrella in which we have so many sections to take care of separately. You know, we have security in so many domains. Physical security, you know, we have food security. We have health. We have education. We have environment. And also we have, you know, well, when I speak about security, even physical integrity, like in the families, you know, all of these are part of that. So we really want to make sure that people are really listened to and they have a place to go. And for, in terms of psychological speaking, first of all, know where you can go, where you can really be listened to.
Have a refuge.
Have a refuge. Yeah, so this is what we really try to do. And based on that, we know where everyone is at which level everyone is, what is everyone's reality. And that's how we can really better handle the cases.
Now, before we take a little break, I do want to ask about the history of OPPFI. We will be talking about tolerance when we come back. We're going to be talking about some of your great successes, some of your barriers, so that we can learn from you. Because most of the folks listening will be part of civil society, NGOs. They want to make change. They want to get things done. And they know you've taken a lot on your plate with a great deal of success. So before we get into that and take our break, I do want to talk about the history of the organization. How old is it? When did it start? What was the motivation and impetus behind it?
The organization started officially in 1995. Before then, of course, there were activities going on and really trying to really have us registered. So we got this registration officially in 1995. So the motivation is, of course, the founder is Osoronko Nanayabani, is a UN peace messenger. He's been working during his entire career, I can say, at the UN, you know, as a field agent, you know, traveling around the world to really helping people, you know, and solve really the world problems. So when he retired, he said he cannot really sit down like that. He really still needs, the way he saw the world, he really still want to serve them more, even if he is no longer, you know, working as a UN agent, as a retiree, he would like to still continue with that service. And that's really the idea behind the creation of OPPFI. So that based on his personal experience, he could also help other people and he could really share this experience.
You know, I'm fascinated. Yeah. I'm fascinated by this. I don't know if you know why, but if you do, I'd be fascinated to hear it. The fact that this is a gentleman who's been around the world, he's seen the problems of the world. He's dealt with so many kinds of problems. But when it came to his own self-life purpose, he selected this particular cause, battering children, very, very intimate problems. Not, as we would say, world peace or world hunger, but an intimate family issue. Do you know why that would be something that inspired him of all the things he could have tackled?
Right. The point is, you know, we talk about world peace. We talk about wars, ending wars, you know, ending famines, you know, bringing solutions to the environment, the environmental issues. But every individual really counts in all these, even though we might not see it, but every individual really counts. So world, as I say, is a different level. So everybody lives in their own reality. So in addition to whatever is going on blatantly that everybody can see and really say, okay, this is the issue. But these are the group of people in the society is really left behind. You know, the battered women. We don't know what's going on between a husband and a wife. We don't know really, probably, you know, there's something going on at home. We don't know. We are really not there. But if the wife really takes the courage to step out one day and to have somebody to hear her, to really express what she's going through, then we will come to realize that, okay, there's a big issue going on. So many people are living in that very, you know, sad life, even though we pretend everything's okay. But really, so many people around the world, there's abuse everywhere, and children also. So he says that mainly with his experience also around the world, and also as he's from Ghana. So we are really aware of all this. So he said, well, let me really focus more on that so that they can be also be part of the world. They can really create a future for themselves. They can really be listened to. They can really be brought to the attention of everyone. And that's really why he really decided to focus more on that.
You know, I find this not only inspirational, but very instructive and very thought-provoking, because we have not been successful as a planet in finding peace and tolerance. We have not been successful in tackling the biggest issues that we think we can see, that we all believe that we know and see through the news. But we have been more successful on a one-on-one help. Every single time we tackle one life at a time, it seems to work. So maybe we should be doing that from the small to the big instead of the big to the small. And when we come back, we're going to talk to you, Adassi, about the successes. But be aware, hold on to your hat. We're also going to be talking about the barriers. Don't you guys go anywhere. You can become a much more active member of GNIC. There are so many ways to participate, from reading our social media posts, from reposting those posts, from making your organization more active in our subcommittees, and of course, by submitting your thoughts for guests for this podcast, as well as articles and information for our reporter. This is Adrienne Berg, and today I am delighted to be interviewing Gloria Blackwell. She is the CEO of the AAUW. She's the main representative to the United Nations from the AAUW. And of course, that is America's largest group of university women. And among her many accomplishments is her 15-year management of the AAUW's highly esteemed fellowship and grants program, awarding more than $70 million in funding to women scholars and programs in the U.S. and overseas. We will certainly be speaking about that. She's been the driving force between the AAUW's signature programs, including its salary negotiation trainings, which has reached nearly 190,000 people nationwide. Pay equity is definitely on her agenda. We'll be speaking about how she does that, how she does her fundraising, and how she reaches out for new members. If these are of interest to you, and they should be, I am so thrilled to introduce you to Gloria Blackwell. This will be our very first representative of a university group. So tell us what the missions are that you've been dealing with and the overall concept of why the organization was formed in the first place.
So the American Association of University Women was founded in 1881. So more than 140 years ago, at a time when, you know, there weren't many women college students. They were few and far between. And it was founded by a small group of women, college graduates, who really wanted to encourage more women to pursue higher education. And so in the past 140 years, they have grown into an organization that now has about 800 branches across the U.S., and as well as 600 college and university partners. It's an organization whose mission is to advance gender equity for women and girls through research, education, and advocacy. And I would certainly say that AAUW has been a very successful organization, and it really evolved from a small group of women and turned into an organization that really advances women's economic security by supporting education, by doing research, and advocating for women's rights.
So this is a learning experience right here, because one of the things that you've explained to us is that over 140 years, the statement of the mission hasn't changed, but certainly the focus has. I want to discuss something we call in the trade mission shift. Girls, when this began, was very different than today. So you are really looking at things like STEM careers, women in technology, equal work for equal pay, things that possibly the founders did not have in mind. And the future is going to be even more different. So how do you deal with that within the organization? How do you create your strategies so that this is always current, fresh, and applicable to girls today?
So the evolution of the strategic planning of the organization has really been influenced about what is happening in our world today. So for example, even early on, one of the reasons why so much research was done by the organization was really to sort of dispel many of the myths and the falsehoods about women. One of our first research reports focused on the fact that women were not encouraged to pursue higher education because a report had been issued by Harvard University that indicated that women who pursued higher education would become infertile and not able to have children.
Okay.
So AAUW basically did their research and interviewed several thousand women who had college degrees, did the research and found out that that actually wasn't the cause.
Really?
And there was no connection to that. And so, you know, one of the ways that we have been able to continue to move forward is to really make sure that the organization was being really adaptive, being resilient, and also making sure that the issues of the day were being addressed. So the progress, obviously, you know, that women have made since 1881 is important. You know, when we look at the work that we have done fighting for pay equity, supporting through our fellowships and grants, doing our research around women in STEM, all of those have come about because women have had more opportunities. And so when we look at the ways in which AAUW has also wanted to ensure that women can take their rightful place in society, we've also seen that when there is an area, for example, the gender pay gap, where women had not been making as much progress, we really typically would take a three-pronged approach, you know, doing the research, doing the advocacy that's needed to get the attention of legislators, and then also creating programs in order to really shift how women are able to benefit from the results of the advocacy as well. A good example of that is, you know, the gender pay gap. Not only did we do quite a bit of research, The Simple Truth About the Gender Pay Gap is our annual report. We took that research, took it up to Capitol Hill, and made sure that legislators understood what the pay gap really meant and the impact that it had on women. And then we had the opportunity to work with the salary negotiation program in order to give women the skills necessary in order to advocate for themselves and negotiate a higher salary. And so it's a perfect example of how not only have our branches across the U.S., gone to the state houses and really made the case for pay equity laws. And now there are pay equity laws in every state, including the District of Columbia, as well as Guam and Puerto Rico. Those are the ways that AAW will take an issue and make sure that it's not just a research report sitting on a shelf, but that it really is focused on activism as well as research and programming.
So you make two points that must resonate with our listeners. One is that you can be politically active without politicizing, so that you're there with the message. But the message is well-researched, not mere rhetoric, and it's an enormous part of successful advocacy. But the second thing that you mentioned, and I want to really delve into this, take a deep dive into this when we come back from our little break, is that you are a membership organization. And so you took what we'll say is a high-level problem, inequality in pay. You brought it to political forums that could do something about it. But then you did something that I think is really unique, and that is train your members. So how I have to, in the minute we have, you have a membership organization. How do you solicit members right now? It's a very large organization already, but you're always looking for new members. And how do you solicit the members?
So we do membership campaigns because we have ways that you can be a member at the local branch level, you can be a state level member, or you can be a national level member. So there are ways to get involved, whether you're just supporting the mission by being a member and contributing to AUW at the national level, or really digging in at the state and branch level. Becoming a member is the only qualification for becoming a member is that members need to hold an associate's degree or higher to become a member of AAUW. Our local states and branches also do branch membership outreach through social media, through local in-person gatherings and virtual gatherings as well. So we're always looking for ways that we can bring AAUW's mission out into the world. Another large group that we really focus on as well are the recipients of our AAUW fellowships and grants.
Yes.
So over the years, we have awarded over 14,000 fellowships and grants. To scholars, to community-based programs that focus on advancing equity and education for girls. And so they're a huge part of the AAUW community that we also solicit for our membership. But the bottom line is, to become a member of AAUW, we really look for people who believe in the mission and who are dedicated to the mission of the organization. We have branches in every state. They are trained. They do advocacy work. And it really is important because, as you mentioned, there is power in numbers.
There is power in numbers. Now, when we come back from our little break, I want to continue this part of the conversation because it's so important to any NGO. And that is your Gloria Blackwell's belief, which we spoke about before the show, that people do not realize how much they can do in their community. And, of course, she's empowering. The organization empowers the members to get out there and make things happen. We're going to talk about that and make sure that you don't see this as a missed opportunity and how you can grab this important motivation for new members, existing members, by empowering them to get out and actually make change. Don't you go anywhere. And now some news you can use. Did you know that you can create a course and that course can be posted free of charge? They do all of the work on the GNEC course outlines. Yes, it can. So if you are an NGO that has a special technique for strategy, for fundraising, for staffing, for getting your constituents to take part. Something else that is really working for you, that you think can be a model for other NGOs, you can create a course. And not only create that course, but you can have it posted for the almost 2,000 NGOs represented by GNEC. Now, how do you do that? Very simple. You go to gnec.ngo, gnec.ngo, and you take a look at the services that GNEC offers you as a member. They include almost 40,000 courses that can be useful to you or your constituents in many areas of learning, but also offer you a platform to put on your own course. We have with us today Villarino Fiore, to say that, and she is the executive director of OAF, OAF, Organization of American Firefighters, and is vice president, Philip Stittleberg, and he is the vice president of OAF. I'm going to see if I can say Organización Bomberos de Americas. So here we go. Why is this different? I will tell you. Because we have always been speaking to organizations that are looking at individual rights of folks that have been marginalized one way or another. This is our very first NGO discussion with a group that brings other groups together, where their constituents are other organizations that are powerful organizations and yet need a lot of support, and they get it from each other. So the issue of collaboration, which is one of the big, big principles of GNEC, is something we're certainly going to speak about. So first, let's get a description of this organization. Lucia, you are on. You are the director, the executive director of OAF. Tell us how the organization began and what's the mission behind it.
Thanks, Adrienne. Good morning, good afternoon, good night to everyone here. And we are very happy of being here with you today. OBA was born in 2006. There was 5 founding members, which were fire services, that said, okay, we need to collaborate because disasters start the cycle of poverty in our nations. We are in Latin America and the Caribbean. And we need to better develop our capacities to prevent and respond to them. So that's how our organization started. OBA is the biggest international cooperation organization between fire services. And our aim is to professionalize the service of firefighters in Latin America and the Caribbean. You have to know that in many of our countries, fire services are volunteer services, are community-based services. And we hope that through doing so, we will help our nations to be more secure and resilient.
Well, a fantastic mission, and it's certainly working, very much needed, a life-saving mission. So let's say hello to Phil for a moment here. And Phil, I'm going to set the stage. Believe it or not, I lived in a community in the state of New Jersey where only volunteer firemen were. We had no fire department. I know it's hard to believe because you think of New Jersey as so urban, and you are from Wisconsin. So question, what did you have to teach? You've been a firefighter professional and a volunteer. What have you found in your challenges? And I guess I would also say, because of the organization, your success in imparting new learning and learning yourself?
I think that the major challenge that I've experienced over the years is one of time. Not my own time necessarily, although that's certainly a factor too. But the time of the people who are trying to address. New Jersey is not unlike most of the states in the United States that you just mentioned. Actually, about 70% of all the firefighters in the United States are indeed volunteers. So it's a very, very large group, about 800,000
yes.
of us.
Very surprising, isn't it, to most people?
And,
isn't? Sure.
And that's a little known fact. And interestingly enough, throughout OBA, that tends to be the case internationally also, is that the volunteer sector is the predominant a provider of fire protection to a major portion of the various countries. So the challenge I have found is in being able to deliver what the firefighters need to know in a time frame, both in terms of hours and minutes spent, and in terms of flexibility of delivery, in other words, making it available when they can do it, so that they can learn what they need to know on the schedule that they can accommodate.
This is a very important thing when you're dealing with volunteers everywhere. So I'm going to actually throw that over to Lucia now. This is a volunteer effort, as Phil says, in most places. How did you get the organizations themselves to collaborate with you so that they would accept your learning and then learn from each other as well? How do you outreach to add also new firefighting organizations?
Well, that's a great question, Adrian. I think for start, fire services are eager to learn. In Latin America, there's a very big gap in information and knowledge. Many of the fire trainings or the latest news and information is in English. So they are all the time reaching to new bridges and opportunities to be better, to serve better, and to learn how to help better their communities. From our side of the pie, let's say, from our view, we try to reach every fire department and every fire service in the Latin America and the Caribbean. We have a strategic plan that we work in with every national delegate to get to know all the fire services or the biggest fire services that might be looking for an answer like our organization. And we reach out directly. We many times try to visit or send someone that is closer to there. Luckily, in the latest years, OVA, Organización de Bomberos Americanos, has become bigger. So people get to know us through our social networks. And we were starting to see that role in the inverse way. And fire services are reaching directly to us. But in the beginning, it was a very, very handcrafted job of investigating the fire service in every country.
Phil, let me throw this to you now. So Lucia gave us a very good idea. She said two magic words. One was eager to learn. That was one. And the other was social media, right? So let's start with you with the eager to learn. I had the privilege of being in Brazil during the Christmas vacation. And I went to the favelas. And in those favelas, I was again, blown away by the artists, by the by some of the beautiful churches there that nobody ever mentions, and the wonderful people. But I would assume this is a fire nightmare. So you must be teaching different things to different organizations under different circumstances in which they are firefighting. You just give us an example of what they might be learning.
Well, one of the things that's a major challenge typically for most volunteers, since they are in rural parts of the country, and that's true not just in the U.S., but throughout all of OBA, is simply establishing water supply. Mm-hmm. It's not a situation where you pull up to a fire hydrant and you've got water. So establishing a water supply itself is a problem. Also, for many, just the travel distance involved. And that's true even in the United States and some of the Western states in particular, but certainly even much more in some of our Southern, South America countries. The travel distance to the call and the roads over which they must pass can be a major problem. Also, you mentioned many older buildings we all remember the fire in Notre Dame in Paris a few years ago. Tremendously, the 1,000-year-old very important building, but presented tremendous challenges because of the way it was constructed. And that's true in many of the older cities, where many of the older, particularly tends to be churches frequently, are of very ancient construction and present some very serious challenges in terms, first of all, of trying to attack a fire, and second of all, in terms of the imminence of structural collapse in those buildings.
So when we come back, we're going to throw this over to Lucia because I want to ask about that social media. Here we have Phil outlining for us water supply issues, distance from the site of the fire issues, materials that could be burning, old materials. Again, I, a veteran traveler, been to Cambodia recently and seen homes on stilts. I can't even imagine. They just put a road in, Phil. They just put a road in to be able to firefight. So we come back, we're going to talk to both of you about social media and other ways that you've reached out to these organizations that our listeners could use, regardless of their mission and regardless of where they were. So don't you guys go away. And now, news you can use. I don't know if you know everything that GNEC does, but it's important news to you. So please take a look. It's a very simple website. It's GNEC.NGO, not .org, .NGO. And what will you find there? You'd be surprised. Number one, you will find a way to access almost 40,000 courses free of charge. Better yet, do you have a course? Is there something that you would like to teach other NGOs? Well, you can apply to have that placed on there free, and we will teach you how to create that course. Big deal. Next, you will also discover our hackathons. We have prizes. We just finished up the 2023 hackathon to young folks who really have solutions for world change. What else will you find there? Well, soon we're going to have a directory where you will be able to put in the information, so that all of our 1,500 to 2,000 NGOs can find you. And of course, you can subscribe there to the newsletter where you'll be getting reports. But better yet, do you have something to announce in our newsletter? Well, simply go right there to gnec.ngo and you will see our editorial standards. And finally, you want to be on this show. Yes, you want to be on this show. So go there, take a look at On the Ground, and you can personally email me, adrianegberg@gmail.com, and you'll find the full spelling of the name right there on gnec.ngo. And how to promote the interaction between civil society, folks, individuals, and the United Nations, so that it really becomes in the minds of those who are interested the significant resource that it really can be. And we're going to kick this off with Dr. Bobby Nasser. She's represented the International Federation of Settlements and Neighborhood Centers, called the IFS, you'll hear more about that later, at the United Nations since 1991. And she served as the executive committee of the NGO Committee on Human Rights since 1997 and currently serves as its co-chair. Now, Dr. Nasser is a mental health clinician, has been so since 1969, so this is not her first rodeo in dealing with very significant issues today. She's worked with refugee communities for the past 36 years, including providing counseling to survivors of torture, human rights training, and leadership development. And she is currently on the board of South Asian Council for Social Services and a senior advisor for the International Center for Advocates Against Discrimination. And I first had the pleasure of meeting her and seeing how she operates, and I'm using that word really wisely, with regard to creating coalitions at an event this April at the United Nations, where she chaired a committee meeting and a wonderful presentation regarding the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights and the NGO Committee on Human Rights. And what she was there to accomplish, and I think did so, was to really understand and help the audience, the attendees, understand how they can communicate and work with the United Nations and use it as a rich resource, something very important to all who are listening. So thank you, Bobby, for being with us today.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And I think your introduction was excellent. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Well, I'll tell you, I could have said a lot more because, as I said, you are an extremely experienced advocate. And you not only talk the talk, but you also walk the walk and deal directly with direct services, as well as with the advocacy and policymaking. So let's talk about that first. Did you simply wake up in the morning and say, you know what we really need? We need a big event at the United Nations where we can really talk to the High Commissioner's Office of Human Rights? Or how did you go about making that happen?
Okay, so I'm very happy that you're asking the question, happy to answer it. My story is I'm a retired social work professor, and when I was still active as a professor, I found out that there was this possibility of being more involved at the UN, and because I'm in New York City, it makes it much physically easier to get there. So I started exploring the whole world of non-governmental organizations and how to interact at the UN, and I found out that it can be done. And so this leads me to what happened when you came to this meeting that happened on April 3rd. Okay, so this, as you explained, was an exchange, a dialogue between the Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights and different members of civil society. And the way this came to pass is that starting back in 2011, through the NGO Committee on Human Rights, I had this ongoing invitation and involvement with the office to make sure that we could, meaning NGOs in general, could have a direct conversation dialogue with both the ASG, sometimes it was the High Commissioner, him or herself, and also members of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And this has been a very productive exchange on both sides. They do want to be with us. In other words, the people that work within the Secretariat and specifically within the Office of the High Commissioner are very happy to have these exchanges. And they understand very well that the way the different mechanisms have come to pass, that's kind of a technical term, but there are a lot of different aspects of the ways that we as NGOs can interact with within the, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but there are these human rights treaties. There are quite a few ways that we can directly interact. In other words, if you or I are exposed to or have intimate knowledge of a human rights violation, it could be anything from something that we all know about, unfortunately, something like torture, or it could be all the way to economic problems with housing or water, or, you know, the kinds of things we think more as environmental. There are parts of the human rights system that we can go ahead and directly go to them with our issues, complaints, and then that's the most important part of developing coalitions, because they like it much better, as any part of the UN likes it, if we come together. They don't, you know, it's not as good if it's one NGO has one thing to say, another NGO has another slightly different thing to say.
Sure, you need a consistent and clear message because it becomes more powerful. And to tell you that this really website, the NGO website for GNIC, and also this podcast is really all about that. It's about how to create coalitions, how to break silos so that your voice is stronger. Now, let's get specific. Let's go over to your NGO, the International Federation of Settlements and Neighborhood Centers, IFS. It is an NGO, and it does identify issues, and it does integrate with the systems, or you call the mechanics, the mechanisms that have to do with the United Nations, particularly with regard to human rights. So to make it vivid, give us an example of something that that particular NGO might already have done, or what you're thinking of doing, or a different NGO that really worked with regard to integrating and getting the message across to the High Commissioner.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about this more as an ongoing process and also an ongoing challenge. So the organization I represent is basically throughout, I guess it's something like 40 plus countries at this point, we have, these are community-based organizations. So I'm much more familiar with them here in the New York City area. I think they're more prevalent, but I'm sure they exist in, I know they do in parts of the West Coast. But this would be your all-purpose community organization that's very involved in meeting the needs of people that live in the community. So for instance, I know you're involved with a lot of the activity that has to do with human rights for older persons.
Correct.
So a lot of our agencies directly serve older persons. So then what we've done is we've tried our best to make sure that within the NGO world, that the issues that we discover on the ground in a very intimate way are brought into the conversation. And that's, I think, very important. We frequently do our best to bring in people that actually are experiencing whatever condition we're talking about. I think that's always a more powerful way to communicate. So we do quite a bit of that. And I'd say in terms of our success, it's been more when we're part of a coalition. So in this case, I'm referencing working with people that are older. But we've also done this with people that are migrants and having problems in terms of that kind of discrimination. We've also done it with people that are dealing with criminal justice system and making sure that they have more of a voice in coalition. So it cuts across quite a bit.
So let's talk about a toolkit. I'm going to call it a toolkit. It might be. Yeah.
Good language.
it's a great way of, and it can be real, an actual toolkit where, you know, you get hashtags and you get infographics and you get different things you can post or letters or petitions. But the toolkit could also be speaking for advocacy. So I'm going to put you on the spot. I was speaking with Bobby Nasser here. She is really a veteran of advocacy, representing the International Federation of Settlements, the IFS, at the United Nations since 1991, on the NGO Committee on Human Rights since 1997, and currently its co-chair. So I think it's fair. I think it's fair play to really give you a real example so okay. that you can mentor the people listening here okay. who do not have all those years of experience.
Sure.
So right now, and you mentioned the field of aging, so I'm just going to use that as an example. We have a terrible human rights issue, we believe, and that is certain older women, particularly older women, are having their human rights taken away as a land grab.
Yes.
The real reasons for calling them demented or having no capacity or even witches is to incarcerate them or get them away from their property, and there's a land grab. All right. So right. let us say that there's an NGO that's really concentrated just on this one issue of aging.
Mm-hmm.
What would they do? What would they do to get the problem heard?
Okay, well, one thing I think they should do and could do is deal with several treaty bodies. So I'm going to name one in particular because you mentioned women. And that's the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW. And there's an ongoing openness on the part of the treaty body to have these kind of reports submitted. And I would highly recommend it. It's there's basically a way of finding out about all of this through the website for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And you can, you know, as with any website, you can get to the specifics of how do you enter the problem. But definitely in some parts of the world, this is the most horrendous kind of thing in terms of depriving people of not just their land, but any access to any resources, you know, literally stealing from them. So
correct.
Yeah. So I would start there. There's several other special mechanisms, but I would start with CEDAW. And then I would also just make sure that the world of women's human rights and that whole world, which is a pretty good network, not a bad network, is fully informed. And I've seen this presented frequently during the Commission on the Status of Women too. It's another place that this can, I think I'd go the women's route. Women are pretty good activists when they come together. And I went to Beijing. I've been to some of the conferences related to women, and that would be my, those two things would be my top two recommendations.
And a follow-up to that, really simple question. In terms of what you have considered to be the most powerful advocacy, and I'm specifically talking about human rights, and I'm specifically talking to your wheelhouse, has it been creating an event as you did at the United Nations? Has it been petitions? What is the physical product that you think an NGO should work on in getting across? If you were to pick one with their limited resources and their limited amount of time for their advocacy.
Okay, well, you've asked a very challenging question because I never like to have just one. I like to have as many as possible.
That's an answer. That's an answer. Okay. Maybe that's something we have to hear.
Okay, so I always, and this goes for domestic politics as well as international issues like the type we're talking about now. I think to keep ourselves from getting depressed, we have to have several ways of approaching a problem, because if we hit a wall in one way, then it's good to go to another. But I have seen specifically the coalitions that have developed on women's issues to be very effective. And so the one would be that I would work very closely with the NGO Committee on the Status of Women, focusing on, and if we're talking about this issue we were just talking about, I would focus on that one there, even more so than working on with the aging coalition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So pick the right partners is what you're saying, and see how successful they've been. So
yes.
before I have a couple of more questions, but the one that I usually ask last, but in your case, I want to ask it before last. If you were right now talking to somebody very close to you who was a young person, and they said to you, you know, Bobby, I'm very interested in advocacy and I'm very interested in human rights, but I don't want to get disappointed. I don't want to feel that I'm accomplishing nothing. I really want to make things happen. What would you say to them? Because you did mention the word depressed, and I hear it over and over again for people in civil society that are really trying hard, what I call change the world with their words and with their actions. You can get a little bit of a burnout. What would you say to a young person so they could sustain the kind of energy that you have for all of these decades?
Okay, so the main thing is I would say don't go it alone. make sure you're with people that are you really feel you're in the same zone with, that you have a real sense of connection. I would also try to make sure that I am connected to people who've been in the game for a while so that they can explain how the system works. And also to have very small goals. I mean, that might sound funny, but I think it's good to have feasible goals. And they might be really small, which is fine, but it's far less discouraging. So it could be as much that your work, in the UN language, it's a lot about making sure that you hold on to certain resolutions. I mean, that's what they're called. And that you get the success of getting your language in a resolution. And I think on the domestic side in the US, we do this all the time when we're working on local legislation or we're working on, it could be state or federal, but anyway. And then when we see we have some success, I think we have to really take a moment, several moments and just say, wow, you know,
celebrate yourself.
Good on us. Good on us. Wow, we did it.
This has been our special edition of On the Ground for May 2025, celebrating peace, justice, and strong organizations. Never stop changing the world.